As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Welcome to the Phil Hay Show that's brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan. From The Square Ball is Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And Edinburgh's finest from The Athletic is Phil Hay.
Hello.
A reminder then, you can subscribe to The Athletic using our sign-up. It's theathletic.com/leadspod to get 33% off the full price of a sub. All Phil's stuff on there, loads of stuff from the Premier League and the whole world of sport as well. Really good piece on Adam Forshaw, which we're going to get into actually in part two of this show. A long read where you've really broken down what he did against Leicester on Sunday.
Worth a look, I thought, partly because he has been away for 2 years and there's that question about whether he's going to be up to Premier League football and to cope with the pace of it and also the technicality of it, which he definitely did, but also to look at the difference he made to the performance, because I did think it was as well as Leeds have played all season, and I do think it's as close as we've seen since August to Bielsa's football at his best.
Theathletic.com/leadspod to sign up. And let's get into that performance then, and best performance of the season. I really enjoyed that on Sunday.
It was a very good game. I thought Leicester contributed to a good game despite being second best, and the feeling from the Leicester end seemed to be that they didn't play particularly well. Didn't get into the game as much as they should. And I think it kind of got away from them, I felt, after the first kind of 10, 15 minutes where they were getting the run on Leeds in midfield a couple of times. There were opportunities where if they'd shaped the pass a little bit better or balanced it, weighted it better, they would have been in, they might well have scored, they might have got ahead. But for Leeds, it was so much more like watching them last season. And I thought even more so, particularly like watching them in the Championship, where they were pretty overwhelming, where the fullbacks worked in the way that Bielsa wants them to work. I think that's something that hasn't quite been clicking this season. The overlapping in particular, but also the underlapping and the way in which Leeds attack, which forces defenders to make decisions they don't want to make, drags them out of position, creates gaps and openings that players round about inside the wingers or who go beyond the wingers can take advantage of. There was far more of that. I thought we saw Dallas come back into the picture in a big way, best he's played without any doubt. And I do think, as much as any good performance was likely to have you thinking, oh, Forshaw's been decent today, I think when I went back and watched it properly, at the time, I thought he played very well. But when I went back and watched it properly and looked at what he'd been doing over the 90 minutes, you could see how, not only him, but him in particular, how he made a difference to the way Leeds played, where they were able to play on the pitch and how they were able to dominate Leicester.
He felt like the glue that held it all together on Sunday, just linking up the centre-backs, the wide players. Calvin Phillips had an outlet. It just all knitted together nicely, I think, with Forshaw in there.
It was really simple. What he did, it was high quality, but there was a lot of simplicity to it. So it was short passes, which were designed to help Leeds play up the pitch. It wasn't just passing for the sake of it. It wasn't just trying to maintain a decent pass completion rate. He was going short for it. He was getting into tight areas. But it was just quick balls that allowed Phillips or allowed him or allowed other players to open up space further up the pitch. As I say, it definitely brought more out of Dallas, who was aggressive on the right in a way that Leeds haven't really been so far this season, and particularly without Ayling. I don't think Ayling has played well in the periods where he's been in the side, but that is what he does. And I think as well, it allowed Struyck to play. Struyck was obviously at left back, and you did wonder when the team was picked whether or not Bielsa had been anticipating two up front for Leicester with three centre backs in the team. But Struyck at left back was a good choice in the end. And I've noticed with Struyck, and I saw this at Norwich as well, that when he steps forward and is a little bit higher up the pitch, and not in a deep area, it really helps Leeds. It helps to create more of a platform. And I was quite interested to look at the average positions that they'd had over the 90. And what you kind of saw was that you had this 2-4-4 formation, which had Forshaw and Phillips locked fairly closely together in the centre circle, but also Stroik in a high position and Dallas likewise on the other side of the pitch. And I think if you're trying to work out why it was that Leeds suddenly looked far more stable and competent in midfield, I think that's where you find the answer. They had two of them in there, and it was a bit more of a double pivot set up. It did mean that Phillips didn't have all the pressure on him to pull the strings and to play out. It made a really big difference. And I think if Forshaw can sustain that, and you do need like a longer run of appearances to get a complete picture, but if he can sustain it, then he holds a starting position for me.
Were you concerned when you saw Strouk at left back? Because I think as much as I love him as a footballer, and I think he's very classy bringing it out from the back and stuff, he can be a little bit slow when he's turned. And I must admit, seeing him at left back, I did have some concerns about it, but I thought it was brilliant.
If you stand face to face with him and see the size of him and his physique, he's nothing like a natural left back to look at. You know, that's not his body shape and it's not his position. He's going to be a centre back long term. There were a couple of instances, and this is what I was saying at the beginning, where Leicester did manage to turn the midfield, and they did a couple of occasions where Tielemans should have been in, and that left side was a little bit flaky to begin with. But he settled into that role really well, and he's just sensible in the way that he plays. He's quite comfortable on the ball, which helps. But I do find that when he goes forward and when he pushes on, he gives you a bit of a platform to work with. He doesn't do anything stupid and he doesn't do anything daft, but he's happy to take the ball and he gives you another passing outlet. I don't think that would necessarily be a formation or a system for every Premier League game. It's not one for every weekend. But it did work on Saturday, and I thought Leeds were very unlucky not to win the game.
Just going back to your average positions graph, I've got it up in front of me here. We are probably a fraction away from having seven people in their half, average positions-wise, which I absolutely love. But it does represent how the game went, doesn't it? Because I agree with your assessment there. And even my dad remarked on this. I mean, my dad is relentlessly negative. He's worse than Michael. But he said, this feels like one of those games where if we just suss it out for 15 minutes and get a grip on the game, figure out what Leicester are going to do, it'll settle down and we should be all right. And I think that's pretty much how it went.
Yeah, and if you watch the first 15 minutes back, and in the piece I picked out some of this with Forshaw, the couple of occasions where he did lose his runner, or at least Leicester got the run on him, were enough for him to work out what they were doing. And after that, he was alive to the players who were trying to run off him and to get into space, like Sumari and Tielemans and others. And once that kind of avenue dried up for Leicester, they didn't create very much and they didn't look like much of a threat. I mean, it is kind of out and out 2-4-fucking-4. Like somebody was saying to me on Twitter earlier, we play 4-4-fucking-2, but the other way round. But
this is the Mike Bassett reference, I presume.
That's right.
Phil's not just somebody.
Not just swearing because I'm Scottish and it's early on a Wednesday morning. But if you remember the game they won at Everton last year, and Rafinha scored late on, they were 1-0 up, and it had been, Leeds deserved to win that, but it had been pretty close game and Everton had chances. And in the 96th minute, Poveda nutmegged Everton defender on the edge of the box, got to the byline, crossed into the box, and you had, as memory serves me right, about 4 or 5 Leeds players in the box looking for a second goal in the 6th minute of injury time. And you used to see that, particularly in Bielsa's first season, but I think right the way through the Championship, of that relentless attempt to make sure that you were outnumbering the opposition and that you were getting bodies forward. And that was how it felt on Sunday. When they broke and the angles that they broke at, the players coming from all directions, it's incredibly difficult to defend against. And I think Leicester found that out. And you have to hope that we've been talking over the past few weeks about it, the exception of Southampton kind of building up, you know, bit by bit. It almost like Bielsa's having to put it back together. And it did feel on Sunday as if they were much, much closer and almost there, particularly with Bamford in the wings waiting to come back.
I found it interesting reading his post-match comments saying that he relayed to the players that he thought that was a lot closer to what they used to look like. It's almost like, I don't know, have they been stripped of a little bit of belief, or because the season's not quite started how they would expect it to? Like, we've come out of the blocks every other season under Bielsa, not quite been that way this season. Maybe it dinted a little bit of confidence and they needed to be shown, you're actually all right, much like they did with Forest before we went to Brentford in the promotion season.
I think confidence is the word rather than belief, because I haven't sensed any kind of shortfall in faith about what they're doing or any loss of faith in the system. It's just hard for players to be confident and upbeat when it's not happening. And it was quite apparent in a few games that it wasn't happening. They weren't playing well. The things that they would, for example, the wing-backs pushing on and those overlaps, it wasn't working in the way that it had been for so long under Bielsa. But that's not to say that it was fatally flawed. And I think that's what we were starting to see in the, you know, the period against Wolves where they came on strong, game against Watford. It just felt, and again at Norwich second half, just making themselves look, you know, that degree better than a really poor side in Norwich. It felt like it was coming in and it was starting to knit together again. And it will help the players massively. I kind of felt that Norwich would help them psychologically because they had to go there and win, and they did. And I think that on Saturday, on Sunday will help again because you're up against a really good, strong side who, okay, don't look at the peak. But with the exception of the VAR goal, Vardy did nothing all game. And I know Vardy kind of does nothing from time to time and then comes up with goals. That's one of the great things about him. But others like Tielemans and so on, they didn't cause problems in the way that they might have done. And I think to contain a side as good as that in the way that Leeds did is a big feather in the cap.
What did you make of Dan James? I feel like I've read opinions varying from he's been a complete waste of money and he's useless to he's really improved the way we press.
Well, is the truth somewhere in the middle?
And he's transforming our season in a very quiet way.
Is there any sort of grey area between the extremes? I don't think 2 months in is a good time to say that it's been a waste of money. I mean, we've been having a similar conversation for well over a year now about Rodrigo, who I do think is starting to feel his way into it now. And he and Rafinha seem to have a pretty good understanding, I feel. When those two link up and when it all gels nicely, that does make Leeds a good side. And I do like the idea of a team with Phillips and Forshaw in it, with Rodrigo at 10 and Bamford ahead of him. James, the one thing I would say about the overlapping and the width that Leeds created was that they didn't make anywhere near enough of it. It's very hard to work out what's going on with Jack Harrison at the moment because he is wildly out of form. There's so much effort coming from him. That's the thing. You're not looking at him and saying that he's hiding or he's not trying or he's not putting it in. He's certainly not phoning in these performances at all. But the technical side of it just isn't coming for him. And I sort of thought that if there was one player on the pitch who needed a chance from a yard out, it was definitely him, you know, just to stick it away and feel a little rush of adrenaline for a change. And I think him missing that kind of summed it up from his perspective. With James, what we're seeing so far, I feel, is what they talked about a lot at Manchester United, which is the running's there, the positioning's there, the kind of reading of the game is there, but the final ball isn't. And again, I feel like if Bielsa can bring that out of him, he'll become a completely, completely different weapon. And somebody who, if he does make the most of the final ball and the positions he gets into, should be very good for Bamford.
We spoke at length last week on the King Raf show, which is worth going back and you can listen to it on your podcast app or it's on YouTube as well, about Rafinha. And we said last week, let's just take as much joy as we can out of seeing him because he brings something to the table every week. And he did it again this week when he knocked it past Soyuncu is one example. The goal is another. He's just, whatever it is, he's got the secret sauce, hasn't he? He's just absolutely brilliant.
You always get a good hint at this from the other journalists that you sat with. And obviously I have a colleague who comes to every game. So it was Rob Tanner who was doing Leicester on Sunday. And all of them sit and say, because not many of them have had the chance to see him in the flesh. You know, so games last season, we won't go into all of them, you know, crowds and so on. You see him on the telly and you see the tricks and everything else. But they all say to me, he looks absolutely incredible. You know, he looks so good. And again, I felt was the best player on the pitch. And when you consider some of the players who are in the Leicester team, it's not a given that that's going to be the case. But as we said last week when we were talking about him, it is now the case of discussing somebody who's fallen into the world-class bracket and just does everything, does absolutely everything. I think I made the point last week that apparently, according to the statistics, his pressing is not, you know, grade A particularly. But it's nice to know that he has something that he can improve on marginally because the rest of it just seems to be there in kind of perfect fettle.
I just find myself smiling at him. And I said last week, just that sense of anticipation every time he picks it up. It's so nice to have a lead side with that in it rather than watching, I don't know, for example, and it's mean to pick out Luke Varney, but I'm going to do it. You know, Luke Varney tripping over his own feet in front of the East Stand. Instead, we're now seeing like Rafinha.
Don't feel bad about picking on Luke Varley.
I'm sure he's had a good living out of the game. But
I thought you'd have gone for that miss from 2 yards out, which I think was almost worse than Harrison's on Sunday.
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I've said over on our show, I've blanked out a lot of everything.
Southampton League Cup, wasn't it, the miss?
That's right, yeah. Have you buried 2011 to 2019.
2018 is the before times. Everything before that, it was just, it's like the Bible, the New Testament, the Old Testament, that kind of thing.
I know, it's funny that I was saying 2019 there, but it seems like everybody can now cope with remembering that Derby playoff because of what's come since. It's sort of a almost like an affectionate part of the big picture. He's not a showboat though, Rafinha, and I think that's the thing. I was watching him getting quite frustrated and angry at points during Sunday's game, and he is a very, very big competitor. I always remember when Adrian signed from Flamengo, and you know there was all the talk about how good he should be and how highly rated he was in Brazil. And I spoke to Tim Vickery at the BBC, and he said to me, he is a very good player. You know, he's a really talented footballer, but he is a bit of a dreamboat. And I'm not convinced that for all his ability and all his potential, that he's actually got it in him to run a game and to be a Premier League footballer for however many years he would like to think that he might be. And actually, we wrote about Adrian a good while ago now. And the story started off with the fact that the club he was with, he'd missed a game of theirs because he'd been at a casino in Monte Carlo. I think he was injured or he was suspended or something like that. But even so, he didn't go to a game because he was at a casino playing in a poker tournament. And you kind of thought, yeah, you see, that's like, that sort of accentuates the difference between him and somebody like Rafinha, who just seems dead set on being Brazilian international for as long as possible, playing in the Premier League, at playing higher level than just the Premier League. And you can see it in him. It's not just the core skill.
It's the hunger, isn't it?
He's
got such a hunger.
Yeah,
I mean, like, he's got terrifying levels of focus and hunger and aggression and stuff. I mean, you know, let's face it, as you start to get older, the edges soften a little bit, don't you? And you're not as idealistic and you're not as driven as you were. You kind of accept how life is. He just seems insane, but in the best way possible.
Yeah, I mean, if like I was saying that Stuart Dallas, I thought, would win Squid Game. I think Rafinha would win Hunger Games, don't you?
Yeah.
He's got such a charisma about him as Rafinha. Like, you want to watch him, whether or not he's got the ball or not. He's always doing something interesting, whether or not he's complaining at a referee. That he somehow looks entertaining when he's doing it, and when he celebrates a goal, and when he's just chasing back, the way he tackles someone, he's got like a fury and something so watchable about everything he does.
He's possessed, isn't he?
Absolutely.
He didn't deserve that equaliser being crashed in after a minute as well by Harvey Barnes. That hurt, did that?
No. The other thing about him is that he understands the structure and he understands the importance of the structure. So it's not as if he's trying to be this out and out stylist who wants everybody to look at him and say, isn't he amazing? You know, it is
Cristiano Ronaldo.
You said it. It is
Bless
part
you.
Of the bigger picture that he fits into. And Bielsa has said, I think I'm repeating myself here, but he said, you know, he's a special player who doesn't look for special treatment. And he is just on a different level. I'm beyond the point now of needing to be convinced that he's the best player at the club.
Yeah, what was your reaction to that that equaliser going in then? Because I think, I mean, we probably can't repeat the words too often on here for fear of getting too sweary marked down, but...
It was a very, very good finish, I'll say that. But it was one of those classic moments where everybody knew the importance of the Rafinha goal, because it was a game that Leeds needed to take something from. No sort of, I didn't have a gut feeling beforehand how it was going to go. We called a draw, although to be fair to you, Dan, you were kind of...
I said soft win, didn't I?
Yeah, and they played well enough to win it. You know, the performance deserved the win. But you go to the ground, and this season in particular, you're not quite sure what's coming. And that goal goes in, and you suddenly think, this is on here, because they're playing well enough. And then you get that kick in the teeth immediately. It was a great finish, but they just weren't quite set properly. It was like the heads hadn't quite come back to where they needed to be. And it sort of reminded me a little bit of when Leeds went to Leicester with Dennis Wise back in, it would have been the 06-07 season, scored just before half time. And this didn't happen on Sunday, but on that occasion, they got totally caught up in celebrating with the away end. And within about 20 seconds of the restart, Leicester had equalised because they were a bit of a mess and they kind of weren't ready and weren't prepared. And I don't know, when I look at it now, I sort of think that had they just seen off that attack and held out for, you know, a good couple of minutes at 1-0 up, I think they'd have won the game.
I think the frustration from my point of view is that the goals that we're scoring this season, they've not been hard to come by, but we're having to work hard for them. And there's been a lot of waste and that kind of stuff around us. We really dug that goal out. We earned it. And then within 60 seconds, we just gave away something. They made it look so easy. It was so cheap. That it just, I think that heightened the sense of frustration. And I go back to the hush that fell over Elland Road after that equaliser went in, from all that high of kind of the release of Rafinha's goal going in to just within a minute, it's like, oh.
It hadn't felt like a goal was coming for them, I think was the thing. That's why it felt a bit unfair. It's almost, and it was such a good finish as well. It's almost one of those where you want to appeal to the ref and be like, oh, that's not really fair, is it? Come on. He's put it right in the top corner. That's not...
That's
cheating.
Can
you have a word?
That's too good.
But it was just a bit reminiscent of the Norwich game as well, wasn't it? Rafinha scores, bingo, everyone thinks sorted, and then suddenly Norwich are heading in off the bar at the other end. But I still have that down as a really good point. I think anything you get against Leicester is a decent result. And yes, you could have had more, but I think Leeds will get more out of this season by playing well rather than picking up results that they don't deserve. I think if they play well over a concerted period, the results will come. That's always been the case with this team, and I kind of feel like it is coming now.
And just to wrap up this bit quickly, let's have a word about Kasper Schmeichel.
Do you think
he left Elland Road happy on Sunday?
No.
Obviously happy to leave Elland Road.
He was given the impression that he didn't leave particularly happy back in 2011 when he got sold. This was an interview on Sunday morning that I sort of stumbled across. Other people had tweeted about
Just to clarify, Phil, had this just been dug up from an old interview or was it a new one?
No, I was under the impression it was a new one.
Oh.
Yeah, although I might be wrong, but either way, the comment struck me as odd. He was saying that he didn't feel like he'd ever been accepted here, and that was because of who his dad was and the Manchester United links. And I'd kind of forgotten this over time, but people were saying to me, you know, there were chants about his dad, but not derogatory towards Kasper Schmeichel, towards his dad, obviously, and the way that football fans tend to.
And it was, as we've said over on our show, it was an olive branch. It was a bit of humour. Look, we can get over the whole Man United links. Let's just, we sing this to you, you acknowledge it, and then it's done. And then we can move on together in harmony.
It's very much what you expect in a football ground and expect when there is that kind of rivalry. And it doesn't seem to me, as much as nobody would ever want to see the dad's abuse like that, you know, that it doesn't seem to me like the biggest deal in the world. I think the bigger point was that I was never under the impression that there was any issue between Schmeichel and the crowd at all. I mean, I remember there being a fair amount of indifference when he left. It wasn't as if people at that stage were looking at him as this quality keeper that we cannot afford to lose. I think the bigger problem with that transfer to Leicester was people were saying, well, quite evidently we need the money, don't we? We clearly don't have much of a budget because we're taking the money for that. And you could feel this impendingly awful window coming, and it was. I mean, I wrote last week about Rehobka, you know, and Rehobka was the first signing of that transfer window, a second choice goalkeeper who took an inordinate amount of time to arrive. They were so slow and you know, just seemed to be so intransigent during that window, like no urgency and clearly not very much in the way of cash. And when Schmeichel left, I think people thought, well, maybe that's a bit of a shame, but I don't see that as the biggest problem in the world at the club. And there didn't seem to be much bitterness towards him. I didn't sense at the time that there was much bitterness in return from him towards the crowd, and I don't really understand why. People have said to me since, though, that Schmeichel finds ways of motivating himself, you know, as they see it, almost finds things to rail against and to fight back against because it's a good way of getting himself going. And there did seem to be an element of that in the comments about Leeds, because I can think of players who've had issues with the crowd at Elland Road in quite a big way, but I never think of him as one of them.
He might have now.
Well, That was the thing, you see, is as you got into the ground, you thought, yeah, if you thought it was bad back then this is going to be slightly different level.
It's like Dan said, if we were to rank the bastards of the before times, Kasper Schmeichel is nowhere near it. He's not even top 50, I no. wouldn't say.
I don't think he even comes into the conversation, does he? I don't think he does.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're going to talk Adam Forshaw now and a 2-year comeback in the making, and what a long road it's been back. So let's have a look at where we started on this journey 2 years ago, because I dare say a good number of people have forgotten, and see what it took to get him back into the first team against Leicester on Sunday. I mean, one hell of a journey. Where did it start? What was the injury in the first place?
Well, everybody always thinks about the Charlton game in September 2019, and I do as well, because that was obviously the last point where we saw him in a league game prior to Leicester on Sunday. And before the Crewe game back in August in the EFL Cup was the first time we'd seen him in any, or the last time we'd seen him in any first team fixture at all. And that huge, huge stretch of time in between that went well over 600 days for the Crewe game and 700 for the Leicester game. These days is a really unusual length of time for a footballer to be out for. Footballers still suffer really serious injuries, particularly when it comes to ligaments and knees and so on. And then you have things like Jimenez with the fractured skull, which you need to take a lot of care over. But even the most complex medical procedures these days for footballers get more and more advanced, and can, you know, recovery times get quicker because techniques get better. And this was one of those classic injuries, really, which started out as something that seemed incredibly minor and almost immaterial, in the sense that everybody to begin with thought it was just the tenant niggle, strain, knock that footballers suffer from, and it would be fine. From what I'm told, he was first aware of this after the friendly against Cagliari, the pre-season before the promotion year. And it was something that just felt like a bit of a pull, a bit of a strain. And it was affecting his groin and a hip, an injury ultimately that Leeds had never really seen before and that was quite rare and hard to deal with. But I still think back to the quotes from Bielsa prior to the Charlton game, when I think Forshaw missed, I am right in saying he missed a game at Derby or a game against Derby. And Bielsa said, Adam Forshaw will be out this weekend, but, you know, he should be back for the following game. And it was the first time that there'd been any sort of talk about Forshaw having that injury. He'd obviously had previous ones. He'd broken his foot just before the start of Bielsa's first season. And actually, he's been really unlucky with injuries right from the very start since Bielsa came in. But at that stage, it did seem as if it was going to be one weekend off, back into training, and then carry on. And it's perfectly obvious that nobody, you know, Forshaw, Bielsa, the medical team at Leeds, nobody at all anticipated or thought that he'd be out for anything like 2 years. I don't think any of them thought he'd be out for any length of time at all. But there it is, him back on Sunday for a very, very emotional game and performance that's taken 2 years to get him there.
Do you have a sense of what it actually was, what the problem was? Have you got any detail on that? Because I think it's hard for us to understand what can keep somebody out of the game for 2 years.
It was something to do with bone or ligament or muscle or something else rubbing between the groin and the hip. And the reason that it was so difficult to treat was because it was the type of injury that you thought should be able to heal in time. You know, with a bit of physio and a bit of rest and a bit of care, it should be okay. And that was why it took probably the best part of 4, 5, 6 months for them to actually send him for the major operation over in Colorado. Because every time they looked at it, the common sense told them that this should just heal. You know, this should sort itself. Even if he needs, say, 3 weeks out, 4 weeks out, this should be okay. But what he was finding was that he would train and he would be fine, and then he would train and it would be a bit uncomfortable, and then it would be okay, but then it would be uncomfortable again. And it stopped him getting into flow, and it stopped him being able to train in the way that he needed to under Bielsa. It stopped him being fit enough for games. And as always happens with players, there's a reluctance, unless it's, you know, if a player suffers an ACL and it's a major injury suffered in a game or in training, then the first protocol is to get them operated on as soon as they possibly can. But for something like that, you see this with players all the time. There's a resistance to going for surgery or any sort of medical procedure, because if you can help it, if you can make it cure or heal naturally, then that is better than kind of putting yourself down for 4, 5, 6 weeks off, however long it takes you to recover. And that was what happened between sort of September 2019 and January, February 2020, was this kind of constant attempt to just get him over the last hurdle, you know, get him over the hill and get him back playing. And it was only really after Christmas that everybody started to think this is going to need an operation, and actually it's going to need something fairly major. And in the end, they sent him to the Stedman Clinic over in the States, a clinic that's been used by a lot of pro footballers previously, Michael Owen, one of them, I think, for surgery on knee injuries. And that's what the Stedman Clinic for a long time seemed to be renowned for, was the quality of knee operations. But they wanted to get him the best care possible, because they were starting to realise by then that it was fairly baffling, this, and they were going to have to do something about it if it wasn't just going to persist forever.
You wonder in years past whether it might have been thrown back into the fray sooner, and then, you know, you used to see players like they'd come back and then break down, where they've sort of treated this one with kid gloves and trod a little bit more carefully. There seems to be increased levels of care in the game these days with physios.
Also, if you're training and playing under Bielsa, it's more intense than it is at a lot of clubs, and Bielsa is not a manager who will say to you, look, just get in the pool for a couple of days, do a bit of gym work for a bit, but, you know, get yourself right at the weekends. We'll just kind of manage you through the week. He wants everybody to be able to train as they play, and with good reason, really, because as you saw on Sunday with Forshaw, you have to be able to play at that level of intensity. And I think that'll probably be the biggest thing for Forshaw out of that game. Not only the technical performance, but the feeling, from what I'm told, he's been fine after the game. The feeling that he came through it no problem, and that he was able to cope with the pace of Leicester's players, the intensity of their running. But yeah, you would find managers who would say that, who would say, you know, just take it a little bit easy through the week, miss the odd session.
Have an injection or something.
Yeah, and we'll manage you through. But it's not a solution to a problem that won't go away. And, you know, Forshaw is now, I think he's 30, but if he isn't 30, he's thereabouts. So a fairly sort of advanced stage in his career. And if he is going to have another 4, 5, 6 years in the game, he does definitely need to get this sorted out, you know, to have it sorted out properly. But the kind of after effect of so much time away from the game is that you're so susceptible to niggles and strains and everything else. I mean, somebody was telling me that one of the things he had done was tooth removal to try it, because there is this chain of thought that the skeleton is affected, or the body is affected, by your teeth. So if you remove teeth from time to time, it can help with muscular issues or nerve issues. So that was one of the many things that was done to him. But there were cleanup operations, this constant attempt to manage him through. But as you'll know, he came back obviously for the 23s last season, and then there was a hamstring problem straight afterwards, and he missed the back end of the season. There was just a decision taken at that point to let him get to the summer, let him get fully fit, come back to pre-season in good shape. And again, this season there've been the odd niggle here and there, because that is kind of the way it goes. That's what the body does to you when you haven't played enough. Because they're so highly tuned footballers. They are properly highly tuned athletes.
Like racing cars, aren't they, I guess?
Well, it is like that, yeah. So if you stick one in the garage for 2 years and then get it out and try to race Lewis Hamilton, you sort of, you know, you pull up on lap two. But I think it seems to me, looking at that on Sunday, like he is definitely cleared the last hurdle. And I don't think that is a reason for Leeds to put all the chips on Forshaw as a central midfielder, but I think it is definitely grounds for optimism that he can play a big part now.
You may well have heard the ice cream van going past then as well.
Didn't even stop, did it?
About a minute ago. You didn't even stop as well. You carried on, which was very professional.
I could see you looking at me thinking, God, are we going to get through this? Yeah, go on.
Oh, shall I just break it off and go get a 99? Talk about the mental side of this as well, because one of the things I mentioned on our show is that the human side of it must have been so difficult to be, you know, football, it's a group sport, isn't it? It's not, you're not just a player in isolation. And he's been removed from that group for 2 years, doing the day in, the day out, the routine stuff, seeing his mates properly, particularly with COVID. So it must have been really tough from him from a mental perspective.
Do you remember the part that he played in the Amazon documentary, the second one?
Was he holding the clapperboard? Take two.
It wasn't quite like that. But when they went to Cardiff for the first game back after lockdown, Forshaw features in that part. And he's sat at home on his sofa and he's kind of talking along through the game. Leeds obviously get beaten down there, don't play especially well. It's not kind of what you want as the starting point for getting promoted. Although you might have forgotten this as well, but he was interviewed around about that time and he basically said words to the effect of, "We're going to absolutely piss this."
Yeah.
And everybody said, "Listen, Adam, I don't know how long you've been around this club."
He's on the painkillers.
But bad things tend to happen when people say that.
That's when they gave him the lobotomy to fix everything else, as well as the teeth being pulled out.
Especially people like me, it should be said. But that gives you, I think, a really good insight into how isolated he must have felt from the football, irrespective of how involved he was in the dressing room. And he is a good figure in the dressing room. And irrespective of how much he was at Thorpe Arch and around the place, when I get the chance to speak to him, I'd like to ask him whether deep down he felt like the promotion was his, whether he felt the same as the rest of the players. And I hope he did, because it was nobody's fault that he was out for so long. And in their own way, everybody plays a part in this, however much they're involved. Even somebody like Nketiah, wasn't it Leeds for a huge amount of time, didn't play that much, but scored some pretty key goals. And it kind of all counts.
Right, it's quite telling they got him on FaceTime, actually. You've seen that in the documentary, when they're FaceTiming him and he's kind of cheering along. Which
absolutely. And, you know, there were messages to the players from Janssen after they were promoted, because it's all, you know, a lot of people, there have been a lot of hands gone into to getting them out of the championship. And, you know, Forshaw was involved in the first season. He was involved in a very, very small part of Bielsa's second season. But I said after the game on Sunday, I tweeted and was kind of saying that footballers at this level get rich very quickly and earn a lot of money, but I don't think money is any substitute for the feeling that you lose in 2 years of your career. There might be some players who don't care and are happy to take the cash, but I think for somebody like Forshaw, who does think a lot about this stuff and has spoken, I think, a few times about how he'd like to get into coaching, so clearly thinks a lot about the game. I've heard people say that he takes a lot of notes about what Bielsa's doing, because if he comes round to the day where he wants to coach, then it's like a life lesson, that, isn't it? You know, make notes of the best coaches you work with and take little bits from them. So there's no way in the world that Forshaw would have sat for 2 years saying, well, it doesn't matter because I've got, you know, the money's still coming in and we're comfortable and this, that and the other. It's been pretty horrendous for him. I can imagine it's been pretty horrendous for the people around him because we've all had from time to time injuries or illnesses or so on. And you tend to be pretty difficult for the people who live with you or the people who work with you. You know, you can be a bit of a pain in the neck.
Is that your wife speaking there, by the way?
Absolutely.
Your recent operation.
It absolutely will be, yeah. Yeah, definitely. But it's very hard to be optimistic and upbeat. And I mean, only he could say this, but there's been a huge amount of conversation when it comes to Forshaw about will he play for Leeds again. If I was him, I think there would have been times where I'd be thinking, am I going to play again, full stop? And given that you're only 30, if that had come to pass and if this injury had done for him, that's a huge amount of time, open water ahead of you, where you don't have a career and you don't have any kind of direction or you don't know what you're going to do.
And it's been snatched away, hasn't it? That's the other side of it.
Totally,
is that football,
snatched away.
Footballers, you know, they're going a gradual downslope and they know that the end is coming, and most of them make the decision to end their careers on their own terms, whereas this would have been forced upon him at age 28.
I looked at him when he came out for the warm-up against Crewe, which was his first team game back, and he honestly looked like he was floating in the air. He just looked so happy. And I think you could see in his body language there that it did genuinely matter to him, and it has mattered to him that he hasn't been able to play. And I'm sure he's delighted for how it's gone for the rest of the players. But it's tough, isn't it, when you don't feel like you're properly involved?
And yet it is indeed, like when he came over to the East Stand family, presumably in the East Stand boxes, he looked pretty emotional.
Family there, yeah.
And in the wake of kind of, you know, the adrenaline that you've got from being inside the stadium, and I was walking back down the East Stand towards the exit to go home, I almost wanted to go down on the pitch and hug him on Sunday. So you've done great, lad. You've done great.
I think Bielsa felt like that. I mean, one of the good things about Sunday was that we were kind of able to cut to the chase finally. And because he was back and because he'd played well, Bielsa was pretty much free to say what everybody had been thinking, which is that, as he said, I seriously doubted that this was ever going to happen. You know, I didn't think that he was going to be able to do this because of the amount of time that he's had out. And I think that's the truth. You know, the medical staff will have been persistently optimistic and positive with them because that is what they do. And again, I think people probably underestimate how much pressure they come under trying to deal with somebody like this. But I don't doubt there'll have been points where Forshaw felt exactly like that, you know, doubting that it would come to this. But you might remember that Bielsa was talking about him a little while back, and just before the end of the transfer window, I think, and said Adam Forshaw at his best is a player that we couldn't actually afford at the moment. He'd be at his best, he'd be worth more money than we have to spend. And people have told me that privately, Bielsa thinks that Forshaw, and this goes back a little way, you know, prior to all this, but he kind of felt that Forshaw would suit a Champions League side because of the way he plays and because of what he does, the simple passing that kind of facilitates gaps and space and allows your most talented players to do their thing. He genuinely feels that he could be at that level. And I just thought the setup on Sunday felt so much more balanced. It seemed to bring more players into play. It seemed to let more players thrive. 100%, I would be starting him again at Tottenham if he's fit.
Are we in danger of putting too much on him now after one, what is essentially one performance in a couple of years?
Yeah, that's what I was saying about, you know, putting chips on him. Let's not kind of confuse the discussion of whether Leeds need more central midfielders and whether Forshaw plugs the gap. He makes a big difference there if he's fit. He definitely does. But the other point is still true, and Leeds have been compromised by not having that in the first 10 games. I think that was fairly obvious at the weekend. I mean, we've actually been looking at the Athletic through every Premier League squad and working out, you know, how they balance in terms of players who are in the peak years, players who are before the peak years, and players that are beyond. And what really jumps out from that, amongst a few other things, is that when you look at the central midfield core, yes, there aren't very many of them, but also they are at the other side of what you would consider to be your peak zone. You know, Matthijs Kleek and Forshaw. Calvin Phillips is right in the red zone at the minute. You know, he's right in that peak period. But there isn't an awful lot behind them, and there isn't an awful lot coming up on the rails. They do have Lewis Bate, who was on the bench for the first time, but Bate's very young and Bate is very raw. So, yes, I don't think it can be eggs in Forshaw's basket, but I think they should definitely, you know, if he stays fit, they should be definitely looking to make the most of him.
And you do wonder whether Andrea Radrazzani had a tweet sat in his drafts Sunday night, ready to say, told you so.
Well, if he did, he didn't do it, did he? He thought better of it.
I'm glad he did this time.
Yeah.
Think better of it.
Yeah, and also just don't distract attention from what is, you know, Forshaw's day and Forshaw's moment. I think the two sides of the argument, aren't there? It's reasonable to argue that Forshaw is a very good player, and if he comes back and he stays fit and he's able to play a lot, then he is going to make a difference. That's fine. But there's no denying that Leeds were after a centre mid in the window. There's no denying that they needed a centre mid. There's no denying that that is a position that they're going to have to look at in subsequent transfer windows. So it's not as if this debate isn't nuanced. You know, Forshaw does potentially make a huge difference, but that doesn't change a lot of what we've been talking about.
Listeners, we've got a very small favour to ask. We want to make sure we're making the very best football podcasts out there, so we need to know what you like and what we can do better. We've prepared a survey over at theathleticsurvey.smsinc.co.uk, and if you complete it, you'll be entered into a prize draw to win one of three £100 Amazon shopping vouchers. Now, we're only after the feedback from UK listeners at this stage, and you can only win those Amazon shopping vouchers if you live in England, Scotland, Wales or Northern Ireland. So if that applies to you, then please head on over to theathleticsurvey.smsinc.co.uk. That's theathleticsurvey.smsinc.co.uk. Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
No game to preview this week then on the Phil Hayes Show, because we are in the international break, which is great. The players have had a little bit of time off, as we touched on at the start of the show. Jack Harrison has been photographed at Salt Bay's restaurant in London, and that upset you quite a bit, Phil. Not necessarily the Jack Harrison angle.
I should say it doesn't upset me, Jack Harrison going to Salt Bay's restaurant at all. He's entitled to do what he likes, and they've got time off. It's more the Salt Bay model that...
He can waste his money however he feels.
Yeah, absolutely. You see... The thing with Salt Bay is that if I thought he was some modern day Robin Hood who was fleecing the filthy rich to give to the poor, then I'd let him away with that white t-shirt. But it seems to me that he's fleecing the rich to get very rich. So
that's fine though, isn't it?
You know, get the fuck off my timeline. I mean, that pretty much sums up my position. Not a fan. I mean, when I see him chopping steak, it reminds me of that scene in Indiana Jones where the guy comes up with a big scimitar sword and starts waving it all over the place, and Harrison Ford just shoots him, and you think, yeah, nobody's impressed by that, are they?
It does seem like a weird subset of brands that are developed for footballers, in the same way as when you see like a pair of Balenciaga trainers that are like a grand and look, in all subjective terms, to be absolutely dreadful, but then they're like
well, they sell stuff like high-vis jackets, don't they, that are branded. I mean, it's that sort of thing you would see the guy who waves the lollipops on the airport apron, you know, to direct the planes. That kind of jazz, your standard high-vis, and they're charging like hundreds of quid for it.
Yeah, it's just, I suppose it's just appealing for a subset of people who have a spare 100 grand a week or whatever. Like, well.
Yeah. I mean, spend your money on whatever you like. It's, you know, it's
yours to burn.
Yeah. Personal choice. Absolutely. And as I say, I've got no problem with Jack Harrison going there at all. But if I'm ever seen there, then you have my permission to cut me up with a big knife.
What about you, Michael? Most you've ever spent on a meal out?
Oh, here we go.
What's the peanut buffet these days? No, I mean, I'm not as tight as I'm sometimes made out to be, but
You are.
Well, possibly, but you know, you can get a decent meal for two for, you know,
10 quid.
80 quid. There's no need to go. There's no need to go daft on it, is there? And as well, I mean, there's just no need to put gold on meat, is there? It doesn't improve the taste of it.
No, I don't think that gold leaf stuff does taste of anything, but I feel like we're getting a bit waylaid now.
Yeah, possibly. But this is an in conversation we need to do with Saltby versus Normanton, I think.
But I'm kind of like, do you know what? If that's the grift and that's how you get money out of people to make a nice life for yourself, then I almost admire it.
No.
It's all very weird. The way he gets it and feeds it to people as well. Like, I don't want that.
No, I don't want a sexy man with a knife. No. Okay. Let's move on. Let's talk about other stuff. We need to wrap up. First of all, there's a lot of managerial churn happening going into this window. And also there's the 49ers increased share. So let's do the churn first, shall we? Because everyone's gone mad going into this window. And we've had, a quarter of the managers in the Premier League have lost their jobs now.
Good to see Man United sitting tight, though.
Yeah, absolutely. He needs time. He needs time, doesn't he?
We're sitting on our notes for this podcast, more lives than a cat. Yeah. Solskjaer, but carry on. You quite often see managerial changes coming before an international break because it does give you the chance to take a bit of time over it. Although increasingly, a heck of a lot of clubs seem to know exactly what they're going to do. You know, you saw it with Watford. There's kind of a running joke at Watford that every time an international break comes around, the manager's at risk because that's when they tend to do it. But they had Ranieri through the door in no time, and likewise, Spurs got onto Conte very quickly after getting rid of Nuno. We were saying before the Norwich game, one of the reasons it was so important was because at the end of the game, that was 10 gone and you're more than a quarter of the way into the season. And if you're sat on 7 or 8 points, then you really are talking about relegation form, and you have to start taking that quite seriously. And I think what you can see from Farke going at Norwich and Dean Smith going at Aston Villa and also Nuno, you know, and you know, to drop further down as well, Neil Warnock at Middlesbrough, who was sat last week on Saturday just before Farke went at Norwich, we're far enough into the season now where owners and boards are starting to think this maybe needs to change. If this isn't good now, then the chances are it might not be good come turn of the year, come springtime when it really needs to be, and maybe this is the juncture at which we need to jump. One of the things though that it got me thinking about was how comprehensively well Leeds have held the nerve with Bielsa. I didn't think there was any reason for him to be under ridiculous pressure on the basis of the results. It's the first real sustained downturn that he'd had up until the Norwich game. But there was no hint or sign at all of doubts creeping in, and there was no twitchiness, which I think can't have done any harm when it came to the form picking up. But you are starting to see elsewhere that clubs and boardrooms are twitching, and that's why managers are going.
I don't think any of them has come as a surprise, has it, really? Dean Smith, I wasn't entirely shocked to see him go because, I don't know, I've never been particularly impressed by him.
They've been on a very bad run. And that's the thing, you see. He's spent a fair amount of money down there, to say the least. He's lost Grealish, obviously, but there is potentially a good side at Villa, strong side at Villa. I thought they'd be really good and competitive. And I actually thought they'd be better for selling Grealish because I thought they spent the money pretty well. But 5 defeats on the bounce, I think it is for them. And that does pose questions. That does pose questions even more so when you spent a lot of cash. And even down at Norwich, it wasn't as if Farke and Norwich hadn't spent money. You know, the estimate is about £50 million that they put in the last transfer window to prepare for this season. It just seemed rather bizarre. And Michael did say, actually, last week when I was slating Norwich, that me doing that was going to mean that they were going to get the first win of the season. And lo and behold, there it was. But it seemed odd to me. I guess not that it matters because there's 3 points on the board. But it seemed odd to me to give him that game and then bullet him when they won it. It's very peculiar. I can't work out what's going on at Norwich. And now you see Lampard being linked with that job and Dean Smith being linked with that job. And it all just seems a bit all over the place to me.
You don't often get the sense that there's a plan. And I said this over on our show. One thing I do like about Leeds is there seems to be a plan and they will stick to it. I think just going back to the idea of pressure being on Bielsa, and I think we kind of touched on this before, any question marks over Bielsa are generally about the kind of systematic questions rather than questions about form necessarily. It's always related to, is the squad size big enough? Should they have done more in the transfer window? It's not necessarily the style of play, is it? Where you would say that they're getting that wrong, because we know it works. No.
And also, over 3.5 years, we've said constantly that it's a valid discussion, but it's also a pointless discussion because you're discussing potential changes or tweaks or alterations to style, system or tactics that are just never going to happen. And likewise, in the transfer market, if you ever want Bielsa to have 4 centre forwards, then you'll be 80 plus and still waiting for it to happen if he's here for that long, because he will never ever do it. That's just not how it goes. And I think all of us were basically thinking, can he rectify this poor period by pretty much piecing back together the things that aren't quite there with the team? And I think little by little he has. And again, it's a demonstration of good management, that it's a demonstration of good coaching, and it's a demonstration of how you can do it without being ridiculously ruthless and saying, this isn't working, let's move on to something else. For what it's worth, I think Leeds, more than any other club, would be damaged by changing coach mid-season at the moment, because they are so moulded in Bielsa's ideals of football and his image that it would be really difficult to make a different team from this. Not impossible, but I think it'd be very difficult to make a good team from this overnight. If you were going to change things about them, it would be tough. So it is important to hold your nerve. But at the same time, when I look at Villa, I can kind of see why that has happened.
With Bielsa, do you think he's as completely rigid as we sometimes suspect? Or do you think maybe there is a little bit of scope for change and evolution? Because he seems like a man who absorbs data and will move with what his eyes tell him, the trends, the evidence.
Yes, but I think tactically, he has a very clear idea of what he wants to do. And that's gone back years and years and years and has never changed a great deal. It's never changed much at Leeds. I mean, to give you an example, the 3-3-1-3 versus the 4-1-4-1 is purely predicated on what are the opposition doing. And there doesn't seem to be a situation where the opposition will play two up front and Bielsa will say to himself, but actually I don't rate that front two and I don't think they'll cause us much trouble. So do you know what? I'm going to go four at the back and take a bit of a risk. He will stick to what he does. I don't think he's totally rigid in that he's not open to little tweaks here and there. And part of me sort of wonders, you know, as the January window comes round this time, that all the indications from Leeds have been that they won't do much and potentially won't do anything. But I do feel that in this window, if it's quite obvious from the outside or it feels obvious that they could do with extra here or extra there, if somebody will try to twist his arm on that and to put forward players that will allow them to be stronger for the second half of the season. I'm still of the mindset, to be quite honest, that if they're in good shape, that they'd be better off waiting until next summer, but absolutely making sure next summer that they do make a bigger push. I think that would be a valid strategy. But no, you know, like you say, it does tend to be systematic when you discuss what's going on with him, because he'll go out on his shield when he does. You know, and I've always hoped with him that it won't have to be like that. I've always hoped with him that it will be a sort of natural conclusion, which is kind of nice for everybody and satisfactory for everybody and finishes the whole era off in the way that it should be.
I think our bad form at the start of this year has left me with a weird mental turmoil of facing the prospect of Bielsa not getting to leave on those terms, because I feel like I couldn't quite handle him being hounded out of the club in any way. Mm. Like it's not how I picture it. I picture him sort of a nice sunny final day of the season and him going, no, I'm going to retire now. This is on my terms. I'm leaving. The club's so much better than when I joined. We can all be friends still.
There's scars of Wilco as well in the way he kind
yeah,
of left,
very much so.
Like, and Wembley in 1996 when he got booed.
Yeah, like, I don't think I can emotionally cope with seeing Bielsa hounded out. So I can't begin to entertain the idea that that's how it ends. Mm.
Don't you think, though, that feeling is why there was the support that there was in the second half against Wolves? I think the atmosphere at Elland Road has been brilliant this season. I think it's been so good. And it was there again on Sunday. And it is because people don't want that to happen. People don't want the club to do badly anyway. But I think people feel it more at the moment. It certainly seems to me, because they don't want it to hit the wall under Bielsa. For his sake, as much as anybody else's, they don't want it to happen like that. And I mean, I've enjoyed this season less than the previous three, it has to be said, and I think everybody would probably agree with that. But I'm starting to respect it just as much, because they're having to fight for this, I think, in a way that they haven't had to previously. It's not that they haven't fought for things, it's just that in previous years, the form's been there, the performance have been there. It's come a little bit easier. You know, there hasn't been that pressure on. But I think
that's what I meant about Rafinha's goal as well, is like we're having to really dig these goals out sometimes.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So second half against Norwich, they needed it and they delivered it. Second half against Wolves, everybody could feel that something had to come from that game. And that was why there was that really intense push towards the end. And again, on Sunday, I felt exactly the same. And if there are teams elsewhere who are little by little abandoning the managers mentally or physically or whatever else, I just don't think we're seeing that at Leeds at all. I think they are all still with him. And I think, as is always the case with Bielsa, when it clicks, the players love it because they know how well they're playing and they know how well it's going. And I think they will absolutely be the last bunch who would be wanting to hound him out or to see him gone. And you're right, I just don't think anybody at Ellenborough wants to see that happen.
I do agree about the atmosphere as well. It does feel like we're still in the midst of something special happening with Bielsa.
Yeah.
And everyone's kind of aware of it, and therefore there's a real togetherness.
I think he's dragged us through some moments, hasn't he, as well? I mean, we've talked about the before times, from the utter hopelessness of every season at Leeds, feeling like, well,
what's the point?
We'll finish mid-table, fine, whatever. From that to the Derby defeat in the playoffs, through to essentially being the best bit of the pandemic, was like the only good thing you could have was, you know, watching Leeds be good throughout it. And we've come this far with it that I feel like people have not had enough fun yet. If almost, particularly because we missed a full season and a bit, it's like, well, no, we need to enjoy
this.
We're
owed this, aren't we? A little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think people are determined to have a good time.
I also think that within the kind of Leeds United fan base, the appreciation of what's going on here is really intense in a way that I don't think is necessarily understood entirely further afield. I was looking at some of the coverage of the Leicester game, and quite a lot of it seemed to point to what they felt was a bit of a kind of mediocre performance from Leeds, a bit of that tone of the kind of nothing without Rafinha, which actually on Sunday I thought was the first game for a little while which had said the complete opposite. You know, he's a massive part of that team, but he's going to be. And actually, isn't that true of just about every side? You know,
we were better against Wolves after he went off, funnily enough.
Well, that's the case. But, you know, if you dig around any side, they are always going to have players who make them tick and players who make them better. But I think the appreciation levels of what is going on here and what Bielsa have done are way higher amongst the people who follow the club than they are amongst people who don't. And I still think there is this prevailing view with some people that it would be quite nice, you know, who are not connected to the club, that it might be quite nice to see it all fall apart under Bielsa, because then, you know.
They were right, they can be proved right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To follow on from that, people still ask me about burnout, you know, are we going to get this burnout thing? And personally, I think that if you've gone through 3 years with a squad and they've done what they've done under Bielsa, I just don't think you can apply the burnout argument. It might all go wrong, but that's management, isn't it? Eventually it does go wrong, and it doesn't have to be burnout, and it doesn't have to be players giving up on him or whatever else. It just stops working. That's football. But I really don't feel like we're there. I really don't.
No, it does feel like we are on the cusp of something else as well. I think that's another thing that's baked into the crowd at the minute. There's a real sense of us heading somewhere, and that's what I was talking about the plan a little bit earlier on. And actually the question about the systematic thing and the questions, and you mentioned January there, Phil, leads us into the 49ers actually, and their upping of their stake to 44%, and what does it mean? And I do wonder if, and the question I meant about him not being for turning, if you like, was, will they add another body in January? Maybe just one, because it allows them to then offset some of the work, or even a player, you know, whatever it might be, just a single sign-in that they do in the summer. If the right opportunity comes up, do they bring in somebody else just to freshen things up in midfield, another option from the bench or whatever?
I totally understand that argument, and I think the discussion about it has to be grown up, in the sense that, again, Bielsa will be out of contract next summer, and perhaps they need to say to him, listen, it might be that you carry on beyond there, but if for the sake of argument you don't, then when you leave, the squad still needs to be in a good enough condition for somebody else, another coach, to come in and pick it up. And the age analysis we were doing of the squad, what was very obvious from it was that the spine of the team, and also the spine of the dressing room, is getting, you know, the change there is coming down the track. Definitely Coopers, Idalises, Cleeks and so on. It's not that it needs to be immediate or instant, but they are the players who are going to need replaced first because of the age that they've reached. Further back, you have your Melies and you have your Strikes. Even Rafinha doesn't fall into the kind of peak years age yet. A lot of really good talent there that could be great for Bielsa going forward, could also be great for somebody else to inherit. But as I was saying about the midfielders in part two, when we were talking about Forshaw, there is a gap there. And I sort of wonder whether over the next couple of transfer windows, the summer in particular, Leeds will have to focus on hitting signings in the middle ground, which is players who aren't, because I was looking back, I don't think, unless I'm wrong here, I don't think they've ever signed an outfield player over the age of 29. I think Rodrigo is the oldest. Casilla was 32, but Casilla was a goalkeeper. And the reason for that is that they like resale value and they like potential. And there is bags of that in the squad. There's no doubt about that at all. But they are going to have to make sure that they don't get caught with the departure of the older guard, leaving behind a kind of gap of experience.
And only potential coming through.
That's it. So, you know, that has to be done sensibly, and they have to think about that. From what I'm told about the 49ers latest investment. That's taken them up from 37 to 44%, so an increase of 7%. But it's also the second investment of the year. There was the much bigger investment back in January. It was done in December, but announced in January, that took them much closer to 50%, which everybody sees as the kind of magic number for the change of
49.
Well, yes. But yeah, so the switch from Radrizzani to the 49ers. From what I'm told, this has been planned for a while. So it's not something, and we'd spoken about it on a few podcasts about the fact that this was potentially coming, and the expectation was that the transfer of shares would continue. The indication is that it doesn't necessarily change the plan for January, but it does provide an injection of cash, and you would think that they would be better placed now to do something in January if they need to. I don't think there's a huge amount of money at the club, but I think they would be better placed to do that now than they would have been before the investment. But to go back, for example, to Dan James in August, that was pretty much a case of, at the point where James became available, Radrizzani working out a way to pull the money together, because it wasn't as if there was £25 million sat in the bank waiting to be spent on Dan James. They had to accrue that. So, you know, as I say, the indications are that they will do very little in January, but I'm always interested by the January window, because I do think your intentions in it generally depend on how the season's going, and you cannot predict that.
And there are still deals to be done in that as well, in terms of players who might be out of contract in the summer, so it's the last chance for their clubs to recoup some money on them, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, one who is out of contract in the summer at Leeds is Forshaw, and that is, you know, that is something they're going to have to start thinking about and considering as time goes on. But yeah, I agree with you. I think I'd like to think that the summer was a little bit of a lesson for everybody, in that I think it's commendable to go for the players who specifically fit the remit that you set for them. But if those players aren't there, or if you can't afford them, maybe it is a good idea to bend slightly, you know, just to be a little bit more flexible, to make sure that you're not short. Because watching Forshaw on Sunday, it was hard not to sit there and think they have missed that through the 10 games. You know, they have missed that sort of balance. And with, you know, I still think there's a very good player in Cleek. It's a long time since it's felt like he's played at his best. But if Cleek isn't at his best, then what do you need? You need somebody behind him who can come in and do exactly what Forshaw did on Sunday. That is squad depth, and that is what keeps you right.
Two questions then around the this share purchase. Do you know how much money has gone in, first of all, to go from 37 to 44%?
No. There are no details on Companies House yet. I haven't had a look this morning, but I did have a look last night, and it still hasn't been updated. So that will give us a clearer idea.
And the other question is, do you expect it to tip over the magic 51% at some point in the next 12, 18 months?
My gut feeling is yes. I mean, they're very close now, 6% away. What I can't say is what that would mean for, say, Radrizzani's involvement. You know, he is chairman at the moment. Would that suddenly mean that he is no longer chairman and somebody replaces him, or would the setup continue for a little bit of time? It just seems to me quite obvious that if you're at 44%, the next time you invest any sizable amount of money, assuming that the valuation of Leeds doesn't go through the roof, which it's not likely to, you know, in the next 12 to 18 months, it'll stay fairly steady. That is naturally going to take you very close, if not past. And I don't think personally that the 49ers would be building up to 44% if they didn't intend to go further.
And there is the very obvious point of they've just taken 7% there. The next 7% is 51, and whether that's deliberate.
I don't know particularly, but yeah, I would have thought the next transfer of shares is unlikely to be 2%, 3%. It would seem rather odd that, unless you were desperate for that amount of cash that was coming in. It does seem to be the way it's heading.
Within the 49ers investors, is there any indication as to who is driving this or who's putting the money in? Because I know there are kind of it's not an investment group acting independently. It is driven by certain individuals.
It's like a consortium, really, consortium of investors who've put into 49ers Enterprises, which is the investment arm of the San Francisco 49ers. And they were the first group who invested way back in 2018. Pragmarati is obviously at the forefront of that. People will know that you've got Peter Lowy in the background as well, who is a big Leeds fan and from the fabulously rich Lowy family.
You keep mentioning him in the context of this, Phil. Do you think he's going to have a prominent role going forward?
That I can't say. We've never spoken to him, or we haven't spoken to him since he became director. But the fact that he is a director tells you that he's quite close to the front of it. And I know that he is involved in the discussions and the plans for redeveloping Elland Road. And obviously he has an interest in the club because he's a supporter and has been for a long time. So I am very interested to see what happens with him. And longer term, what his involvement is, what his position is at the club. If it does become a scenario where the 49ers have more than 50% stake, where they become majority shareholder. But I think it's important to remember that he is in the background because he is somebody who does have wealth behind him, but somebody who does have a vested interest too in Leeds being very, very successful. But to all intents and purposes, that, you know, this is being managed and controlled by Marathi and 49ers Enterprises. And like with most of these things, time will tell.
Well, that wraps up the Phil Hayes Show for this week, heading into the international break. No Salt Bay restaurant for us now, I think. Should we go get a Wetherspoons breakfast?
Yeah, like Mackey's. Yeah.
Thanks for listening and watching to this one. Have a look on YouTube for us. You can tweet at the Phil Hayes Show, and we will return next week. In the meantime, to subscribe to The Athletic, go to theathletic.com/Leeds Pod. We'll catch you next time.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.